You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. It's day two of the question and answer phase of President Trump's impeachment trial. We'll look at what was asked and what we learned coming up. First, between 1999 and 2017, the number of deaths reportedly caused, at least in part by alcohol, rose 51% nationwide. That's according to an analysis released this month by the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism. Out of that group, the death rate among women went up much more sharply than among men, though men still experience alcohol-related deaths at a much higher clip than women. Now, this kind of news would be a big motivator for America's nationwide anti-alcohol political lobby, if it existed. But as our next guest writes in a recent piece, while there are strong advocacy groups for and against a wide variety of products and activities, there's a big gap where the alcohol temperance movement used to be. Olga Kazan recently wrote about the history of anti-alcohol politics in the U.S. for The Atlantic. Olga's a staff writer there covering health and science. Olga, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, this is a really interesting perspective you have in this piece. What made you notice the absence of this anti-alcohol political movement?
Yeah, I think I just noticed that whenever people on Twitter or just even in real life, you know, talk about drinking less or, you know, the downsides of alcohol, people kind of tend to shout them down and say, you know, you're a buzzkill or why don't you like to have any fun? And it's kind of interesting because there are actually groups that oppose every other kind of like supposedly fun thing. but alcohol seems to have this kind of free reign.
Yeah, you went hunting for anti-alcohol advocacy groups. What did you find? Nothing really taking it on head-on nationwide.
Yeah, there's not really like a strong group that suggests that nobody should drink alcohol or that alcohol should be banned. That doesn't really exist at all. There's a group called Alcohol Justice, which supports tighter limits on alcohol sales and advertising. So things like bars closing at earlier hours, you know, or less advertising for liquor stores and things like that. And there's also Mothers Against Drunk Driving, but they really only oppose drunk driving. They don't oppose alcohol in general.
And that's not necessarily normal in American history. Once upon a time, anti-alcohol activism was huge. People voted based on it. People ran for office based on it. Can you talk about the past there?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you had the whole temperance movement, you know, that this is, you know, it was a 13-year ban on alcohol that ended in 1933. You know, the Women's Christian Temperance Union, which was the original prohibitionist group, it had 2 million members in 1920. You know, this was really a big point of debate. You know, should people be drinking? Should alcohol be, you know, something that you can easily buy? And that just debate has completely gone away.
What happened? Was it just all prohibition happened and then went away?
Yeah, well, people often say that, you know, well, prohibition didn't work, and so now we don't have it anymore. But it's a little bit more complicated than that. So prohibition did go away. It did fail. The Women's Christian Temperance Union is like a small, much smaller organization that and is mostly active, it appears, in other countries. But essentially, there, you just kind of had this slow transition of the country, kind of seeing alcohol as more of a personal problem. So if you drink too much, it's sort of your kind of responsibility and to get it, you know, resolved. And also, you know, the work of the alcohol lobby and beer makers to promote alcohol as a fun beverage that is really a you know, a wholesome part of American life.
I want to hit a point you just made there. It sounds like we moved it from a category of a social problem, the prevalence of alcohol, to an individual health and psychology problem. And that's a pretty big change.
Yeah, so Alcoholics Anonymous came around in 1935, and it really created this, or kind of pioneered this disease model of alcoholism, which a lot of medical, you know, people in the medical community say is correct, that alcoholism is a medical disorder. But at the same time, they kind of promoted this idea that if you're an alcoholic, you should go to meetings, you should keep yourself accountable. You know, the only person who could make you change is yourself. That's a very different message than we're all drinking too much, so let's pass some laws to make us drink less.
Talking to Olga Kazan from The Atlantic. She recently wrote about the past and present of anti-alcohol politics here in the United States. There isn't much of it in modern-day America, she writes. Olga, let's talk about the people we drank. I drank. The people who don't consider themselves alcoholics. And so there's no problem. But you started looking at what's out there in the health world. And maybe there is a little bit of a problem even beyond sheer alcoholism.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, a lot of people drink. I also drink, for the record. and it's, most people can drink in moderation without a problem. But actually, kind of according to the health community, the safest amount of alcohol to have is none. It really increases your risk of breast cancer. As you mentioned, the number of alcohol-related deaths are climbing. It has a really negative impact on things like liver disease, heart failure, dementia, 7 types of cancer, and of course, fetal alcohol syndrome if you're pregnant while you're drinking. So really, the health community out there is no longer really promoting that nightly glass of red wine. They're mostly saying, maybe you just shouldn't drink at all.
Right. We had this abundance of studies for a while there, it seemed like, that said, hey, yeah, moderate drinking might actually have health benefits. But you also write to some of the research was done by groups funded by the alcohol industry.
Yeah, and that's kind of one of the ways that the alcohol industry has really opened up American society to drinking, which is that they provide grants to scientists whether intentionally or kind of subconsciously, a lot of those scientists went on to find health benefits to drinking. So the most recent example of this was the NIH, which shut down a study on alcohol after the New York Times found that it was actually funded by alcohol companies. So you have these conflicts of interest that are kind of maybe making alcohol out to be healthier than it actually is.
Now, you wrote this piece, and you're not advocating for return to prohibition or anything like that, but there's something about the way we think about alcohol that we seem pretty conflicted about. I don't know. What do you make of our attitude toward alcohol these days?
Yeah, I'm definitely not advocating for prohibition. Like I said, I do drink. It is interesting. We don't really have a lot of discussion about alcohol taxes. Alcohol could stand to be more expensive. It is more expensive in a lot of other countries. We don't really talk about, shutting down bars at earlier hours, certainly not in D.C. where I live. I'm just sort of curious why there's kind of not a big discussion about this kind of significant health factor that is all around us all the time.
We're talking to Olga Kazan, who covers health and science for The Atlantic. We're talking about the relative lack of anti-alcohol advocacy. There's no big anti-alcohol lobby. And there's not a big conversation, she writes, in America today about the downsides of drinking. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think? Do you think that there should be more of a movement, maybe not to ban alcohol, but more anti-alcohol policies, raising taxes, more advocacy about the health risks of drinking, even if you're not an alcoholic? Are you a non-drinker yourself? Is it tough to be out there in social situations when you're not drinking, especially maybe in a state like Wisconsin? Do you think that there is too much of an alcohol culture in our state, in our country, or not? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Olga Kazan from The Atlantic. We're talking about the anti-alcohol movement in the United States, once a really big thing in the country, now not so much. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about how alcohol is treated, talked about, regulated, advertised, experienced, maybe compared to cigarettes, marijuana, and other drugs? What questions do you have for our guest? What thoughts do you have about the way we drink, the way we think about drinking, the way we talk about it, the way we advertise it? And do we need changes in policy one way or another? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Mary is with us in Greendale. Mary, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to call and let you know that we actually, my sisters and I, we just did and are finishing up dry January. And I think it was very eye-opening what it is that not just myself, but my sisters and I all kind of realized what was going on in society and how much alcohol is really part of socializing. And while I didn't feel any of the benefits of not drinking, and there's a lot of websites out there, you know, week two, you should be feeling more energy and everything. I'm not sure I drank that much that I really could have felt it. But I do know that there are people out there that just, I mean, it's just a complete eye-opening experience. If you go on an airplane and you're in first class, you get a free glass of champagne. If you go out with friends, you know, everybody's drinking before, during, and after the meal. If you, you know, go and do pretty much anything, football parties, you name it. And what I also thought was interesting is when people found out that I wasn't drinking, they also didn't drink either.
Interesting. Mary, thank you so much for sharing that. This is a big thing, it seems like, Olga, lately, this dry January thing. And as Mary discovered, a lot of people are using it and then rethinking their relationship with alcohol.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's kind of where the movement took off. Is that alcohol can, you know, decrease your productivity. It can make you have low energy. So people are trying to experiment with, well, what happens if I just remove this, this kind of crutch from my life for a little while? And it can be, you know, harder than you might expect because, as she mentioned, it is so intertwined in every gathering and every get together and, relaxing after work and so much of our lives, alcohol plays a part.
And she said something that I hadn't thought of. Thanks a lot for that call. A social contagion of not drinking, because I usually think of it the other way around, like, oh, if everybody around me is drinking, then it's normal, so I might as well, too. She says just by mentioning that she wasn't drinking, it inspired other people to, at least at that one instance, not have a drink. Have you seen it working that way?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that that can happen, you know, where you have this effect where it's like, oh, I'm not drinking and I'm trying to get these benefits. And then other people maybe want, you know, the benefits of trying that out as well. Or maybe they just feel awkward because, you know, it's not necessarily as fun to be the one slightly tipsy person in a social gathering. You kind of want everyone at that same level. So maybe that's what was going on there.
Thanks a lot for the call. We'll go back to your calls now. Alex is with us in Appleton. Alex, hello.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What'd you want to bring up, Alex?
Yeah. I'm a 28-year-old individual, and what I was able to observe, you know, living in Wisconsin is from a young age, the normalization of how often or how common it is to have a drink, whether it's after work, you got the Packer game going on the weekend or Monday night football, you know, whatever it may be. You know, I come to notice that, you know, adding a drink into the mix has never been a cause for concern, let alone a question, because, you know, just from personal experience, you know, just having a drink after work, winding down, whatever that excuse may be tied to it, I see that, you know, it's something that...
I'll jump in, Alex. You're breaking up a little bit, but we get your point, Olga. This guy, and you know, this is a Wisconsin thing too, but I imagine it's around the country. He says the normalization of drinking. It's any occasion. It's not weird to drink. Do you see that elsewhere in the country?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I live in D.C., which I think has the highest rate of alcohol consumption or possibly alcohol drinkers in the nation. And yeah, the thing to do here really is after work drinks. There's so many bars. We all ride the metro, so we don't have to worry about driving. And that is definitely the norm. And if you're bucking that norm, you know, honestly, that can also be actually more inconvenient than just going along with the crowd and drinking. So I think that's definitely a thing in a lot of parts of the country.
And you also mentioned something that mentioned in your piece, that idea that, hey, after work, I'm drinking to wind down. And we have the idea that drinking is stress relief. And on social media, there's all sorts of jokey things like, ha ha, my stress solution is the wine or whatever. You looked at what research is out there. Is alcohol a good stress cure?
No, unfortunately, it's not. Yeah, a lot of people think it's good for their anxiety, but it kind of has a boomerang effect on anxiety where initially it might relieve it, but it actually makes it worse after the fact. So a lot of people, when they drink a lot, they might say they have next day anxiety. And that's kind of from that boomerang effect that alcohol has.
We'll go back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Rick is with us in Holman. Rick, hello.
Hello there.
What do you want to tell us about, Rick?
Well, first of all, I just wanted to mention that in March I'll be 40 years sober.
Wow.
And back in my
teens and 20s, I drank 3 to 4 quarts of Jack Daniels or vodka a day. And what got me sober is I checked myself into the hospital for 30 days, and I went straight to AA. And there is no doubt in my mind that AA for the last 40 years has kept me sober. When I was still working before I retired, we'd have cocktail parties, you know, at work, and I could only stand in there for maybe half an hour, even after all these years.
Wow.
And then I would just kind of slide out.
Rick, thank you so much. Glad you're still with us, and congratulations being 40 years sober in just a couple months. Olga, it can be, as he said, a challenge, even if you know you have a problem with problem drinking. There's so many, like you said, that workplace cocktail party, it's hard for people to stay away from it.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, joints and marijuana have never actually caused a lethal overdose, but you know, most companies do offer, you know, work, or many companies offer work happy hours where, you know, you can really end up drinking a lot. So it is kind of interesting the kind of different approach we have for alcohol versus other substances.
Thanks for the call. We're talking to Olga Kazan from The Atlantic. A recent piece she wrote looks at the absence of a big anti-alcohol lobby political movement in the United States. Olga, by the way, has a book coming out called Weird, The Power of Being an Outsider in an Insider World. Hope to have you back to talk about that in a little while. Olga, let's go back to our callers now. Brian is with us in Appleton. Brian, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Thanks. Good.
For taking my call.
What'd you want to tell us about, Brian?
Yeah, although I imbibe once in a while in a glass of wine, this last year has been really hard for my family, as my brother in his 50s, we see his life fall apart from the, you know, the overuse of alcohol, and lost his job, his apartment, and pretty much had to help him pick himself back up, and spent 3 months in recovery up in Green Bay, and he's about 8 months sober, but it's still a very fragile time. But you know, I'm starting to see the world through his eyes, where it's like every commercial, every other commercial's alcohol and beer or in billboards, and it's constantly advertised, where I would feel someone in recovery that would make it very difficult. You know, my question is, any legislation coming down where alcohol is treated the same as, you know, cigarettes or drugs in our media and our social media and our commercials, you know, the Super Bowl, you know, any progress towards that?
Brian, thanks for the call. Olga, do you see movements in that direction?
Yeah, I mean, so that's one of the main things that Alcohol Justice is really pushing for, is to have things like billboards, commercials, things like that be more tightly regulated, somewhat like we have with cigarettes, where, you know, you don't see those advertisements, you know, during the Super Bowl. But it doesn't seem to really be picking up a lot of steam. Like, I haven't really seen anything in the health policy world, people talking about this. I just don't really see it being taken up, at least not at a national level. So, that's kind of where things are at right now.
Yeah, I'll say here on the show, I've talked to public health advocates who are calling for this kind of thing, but feeling like they're a voice in the wilderness. And again, there's not really much of a movement that's going to pick up those public health issues and try to turn it into law, it seems like, Olga. And do you see any sign that that's going to change anytime soon?
Well, I mean, the thing is, the beer and alcohol lobby is very powerful. Like, so this, you know, they spend a lot of money. They donate to a lot of political candidates. There's just a lot of different, you know, beer wholesalers. There's craft breweries. Craft breweries are a huge part of local economies. Alcohol sales are a huge part of the restaurant business. It's just really hard for policymakers to go against a lot of these interests that honestly do spend a lot of money to preserve kind of the free reign of alcohol.
Time for one more caller, I think. Pat is with us in Madison. Pat, hello.
Hi. Yeah, I moved from California about 6 years ago to Madison, and I was intrigued by the reality of reading articles and realizing that the DUI rates actually in Wisconsin have some of the highest counties in the entire country. And yet the legislation that's out there that actually penalize people isn't that high. Not that you just put people in jail, but the reality is that people aren't being penalized as high like in a place like California. And, well, if you're not being penalized, people have multiple DUIs here, I'm seeing, to the point where I've seen people drink beer driving down my residential street. And I think that's just kind of crazy here. It's something totally different than what I grew up with.
Pat, thanks for the call. And Olga, unfortunately, Wisconsin known for drunk driving, as Pat was saying. That is the one, and you touched on this earlier, that's the one element of alcohol, at least, where there is a fairly significant national movement to try to pass laws on drunk driving.
Yeah. Mothers Against Drunk Driving is really pushing against, any type of tipsy driving, drunk driving. That's their core thing. But yeah, I mean, as you mentioned, in a lot of these places where there's a strong beer culture or wine culture, if they don't have public transportation, you might see people actually getting behind the wheel, anyway.
Thanks a lot for that call. Olga, in our last minute or so, do you see people, as you've talked to people about this, I imagine you've heard a lot after this piece came out. Do you hear from a lot of people saying, you know, at the very least, can we make more space for the non-drinkers out there to not have to feel like they're not part of the fun if they're not drinking?
Yeah, I was a little afraid after I published this that people would get really mad at me for trying to take away their beer. But I heard from a lot of people who are sober, and they said, you know, thanks for writing this article, because I do feel like alcohol is everywhere. It's in all the ads. You know, it's in all the work happy hours. It's just all around me. And it's nice to know that I'm not crazy and that it's, you know, there's a reason behind this.
Olga, thanks again for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
That's Olga Kazan. She covers health and science for The Atlantic. We talked to her today about some of the history of anti-alcohol advocacy in the United States, why there's much less today than there used to be. There's no modern equivalent of the temperance movement of, say, 100, 150 years ago. You can keep sharing your thoughts, by the way, on the American alcohol culture, on Wisconsin's in particular, if you want. Email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us @CentralTimeWPR. U.S. senators continue to ask questions of House managers and President Trump's legal team in his impeachment trial. This is the second of 2 days of questioning. Republican Rand Paul of Kentucky again submitted a question about the whistleblower whose report started the Ukraine investigation. He did so yesterday as well, but Chief Justice John Roberts blocked it from being read. Roberts refused to read it today as well. Paul then left the Senate chamber and read the question to reporters, which included the alleged whistleblower's name. The Senate is expected to vote tomorrow on whether to allow witnesses. Majority Leader Mitch McConnell reportedly told Republicans that Democrats don't have the 51 votes they need to call witnesses. That could allow McConnell to press ahead with a vote to acquit Trump over the weekend. John Blakeman is a professor and chair of the Political Science Department at UW Stevens Point and co-author of The Supreme Court and the New Federalism from the Rehnquist to the Roberts Court. His areas of expertise includes constitutional law. John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Well, what has stood out to you in the last, 24 hours-ish of question and answer in the Senate?
Well, I think it is the attempt by some Republican senators to try to get the whistleblower's name read out in public, although it is essentially public at this point. And I also think it's the build-up to what's probably going to be a vote tomorrow on whether to call witnesses or not, and sort of the speculation on how that's going to play out.
Let's talk about that whistleblower side issue. In some ways, at this point, there are whistleblower protections in place to encourage people to report when they see wrongdoing. What do you make of this release of his name by U.S. senators?
Well, I think the whistleblower's name has already been released, but it's still, I guess, hard to find. I honestly don't know what the name is, frankly. But it does sort of show you that whistleblower protections, at least at the federal level, are only as robust for the whistleblower as politicians are going to let them be, in a sense.
And you also mentioned the issue of witnesses, that vote coming up. We've heard a couple different reports over the last couple of days. McConnell didn't think he had the votes to block witnesses. Now it seems more like he does think he does. What are you watching for as we approach that witness vote?
Well, I would be watching a handful of Republican senators, you know, assuming that all 47 Democrats would vote to call witnesses. Then you only need four Republicans to cross over and vote, because this is something the Senate is only going to do by a simple majority vote of 51 in favor to call the witnesses. And so, it looks like potentially there are three Republicans, Senator Romney from Utah, Senator Murkowski from Alaska, and Senator Collins from Maine, who have indicated that they would probably vote for witnesses, but that only brings it up to 50, you know, and the latest, Senator McConnell has said the Democrats do not have 51. He didn't say anything about it being 50-50. But if it is a 50-50 tie, that's something to watch, because yeah, then potentially the Chief Justice of the United States can cast the tiebreaker, which would be an historical moment.
Right. Usually in the Senate, check me on my constitution here, if it's a tie ball game, the U.S. vice president is the tiebreaker as president pro tem of the Senate, if I have that right, something
that
like that.
That is correct, but that's only during, well, if we read the constitution a certain way, that's only during regular Senate business,
right,
in a sense. And impeachment would presumably lie outside of that.
Now, I've seen some arguments from legal scholars saying, even if the senators don't vote on this, the Chief Justice here would have the authority to determine that, yeah, we need witnesses here. What do you make of that argument?
I don't know. I mean, potentially, the Chief Justice does have a lot of authority over the process in terms of how evidence can be introduced. We saw that today when he did not read the question asking for the name of the whistleblower. But Chief Justice John Roberts is a very, very cautious Chief Justice, and I honestly could not see him doing something that might upset the balance in the way the Senate is currently operating with impeachment.
But it does highlight an issue. It does seem when it comes to an impeachment trial, we're kind of winging it here, right? We don't have a super solid formula.
No, that's absolutely true. The Constitution's clauses on impeachment are incredibly short. And so, this will be the third impeachment trial, avoiding one with Nixon. But the process seems like it's being reinvented every single time. And that is true. And maybe there's nothing wrong with that, frankly. But it shows you the Constitution itself is very, very vague about how this process is supposed to be structured.
Talking to John Blakeman, political scientist at UW-Stevens Point, looking at the latest on the Senate impeachment trial of President Trump. Historically, have we seen witnesses in the Senate stage of an impeachment trial in all two we have to work with so far?
Oh, gosh. I don't know if I can answer that. I do believe there were witnesses in the Clinton trial. I could be very wrong about that, though. Certainly building up with the Clinton impeachment, there was a lot of witness testimony embedded in the independent counsel's report. The Chase trial, I don't know. That's out of my purview, I guess.
That's okay. Now, looking at the politics here, because impeachment, it's a trial, so in a sense it's legal, but it's obviously political too. What kind of factors do you think senators are looking at when it comes to just, you know, do we want to get this thing done by the end of the week, or having witnesses risking it going on for, I don't know how long, another week, two, 3 weeks?
Yeah, well, I think to take that latter point, risking the trial going on not indefinitely, but if you start calling witnesses, depending on how many witnesses the Democrats want to bring in and how many witnesses the Republicans and ultimately President Trump wants to bring in, it could last a few more weeks. I've seen an outlier prediction that it could even last a couple of months. Once you get into that territory, and of course for Democratic senators who are running for the presidency, that's going to really interfere with their primary. So they're going to have to factor that in, obviously. For the Trump White House, the longer this carries on into the and really butts up into the presidential election season, that's very, very risky in and of itself. You've got a handful of Republican senators who are up for re-election. They would probably like this to be over and done with as quickly as possible.
I want to focus in on one argument. We heard yesterday Alan Dershowitz on the president's team got a lot of attention for this one. He said, and I'm quoting here, if a president does something which he believes will help him get elected in the public interest, that cannot be the kind of quid pro quo that results in impeachment. That's the end of the quote there. I want to give a listen to a response from lead House manager Adam Schiff talking about that this morning.
That is the most absurdly dangerous argument that could have been made. And the fact that they must resort to this level of desperation is the result of the fact that The House managers proved the defendant's scheme involved withholding a military aid, withholding of a coveted White House meeting with the president of Ukraine in order to coerce, to extort, to blackmail that country into conducting or announcing these sham investigations, to helping him cheat in the election.
John, what is your take on that argument from Dershowitz? If the public believes doing a thing in the public interest, his reelection is in the public interest, then it's okay.
Well, I was having this conversation with one of my colleagues just 30 minutes ago, you know, and I pointed out that Dershowitz is an incredibly successful lawyer, you know, and so I think, on the one hand, not to be too cynical, this is just a very good example of his lawyering skills. He's throwing an argument out there. He's hoping that it sticks. It might not, but if not, we'll move on. But, you know, I think the deeper issue that Dershowitz is hitting at, and really what the Trump legal strategy is aiming at, is this notion of executive power that's been bouncing around among Republican presidents since really the first President Bush, and it's sort of now deeply ingrained in conservative circles, and it's what we call the unitary executive. And the argument is simply that the president is relatively unconstrained by the Constitution and by Congress, and in fact, the president has very broad authority, especially to engage in foreign affairs, and most of that authority is not reviewable by Congress. And I think that's what Dershowitz is ultimately hinting at. You know, it's what's in the public interest, broad executive power. Dershowitz has linked it up to Trump's campaign for 2020, which in my mind is a real stretch. But at the end of the day, it's the larger argument about the relatively few limits on the powers of the presidency.
Republican Senator Tom Barrasso of Wyoming was on CNN this morning. He avoided answering whether Trump can do, quote, anything to get reelected if he sees it in the national interest. But he says Dershowitz's argument isn't unique to Trump.
Every president believes his or her election is in the national interest. We saw they played the tape of President Obama talking to Medved about saying, I need some space. After the election, I will have more flexibility. And they said, we will tell, obviously, all right, the leader of Russia at the time, Putin. So every president thinks his or her reelection is the most important thing in the national interest.
Looking at the framers of the Constitution, what do you think, John, they would think of this argument of that kind of power for the president to do anything for their reelection if it's, you know, if they see it as in the national interest?
You know, the framers, especially James Madison, Hamilton, they talked about men of virtue who will come into politics, men who will place their own self-interest below the public's interest, men who will elevate the public's interest above their own. And I, you know, it is the case that politicians are always going to construe their next election as within their interest, and their interest often merges into the public's interest. The interest of the public in their state, the interest of the public in their town, the interest of the public nationally. But that is not what the framers of the Constitution had in mind. You know, they had in mind politicians who would suspend their own self-interest in favor of what was best for the public. And that would not include running for re-election.
We're talking about today's events in President Trump's impeachment trial. John Blakeman is with us, professor and chair of the Political Science Department at UW-Stevens Point. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What would you ask House managers or Trump's legal team if you had the chance in the Senate today to write a question? Should the Senate call witnesses, people like John Bolton, Joe Biden, Hunter Biden? Is it time to end the trial? Do you think Trump should be acquitted or removed from office? What do you think this all means for the presidential race? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about today's question and answer session in President Trump's impeachment trial. Senators asked questions yesterday as well. Tomorrow, the Senate expected to vote on whether to allow witnesses. Political science professor John Blakeman of UW-Stevens Point is with us. He's also co-author of the book The Supreme Court and the New Federalism, From the Rehnquist to the Roberts Court. You can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Do you want to hear testimony from witnesses in the Senate, or should the Senate move to vote as soon as tomorrow or this weekend? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll go to your calls now. Andrew is with us in Palmyra. Andrew, hi.
Hi, I just wanted to call in and voice my opinion on the trial that's going on right now. I've heard a lot of people say that while it isn't a criminal trial, then therefore you don't have necessarily the right to face your accuser. I will say that if you're talking about an anonymous accusation from somebody that will be able to unseat someone from the highest elected office in the United States, I just want people to think about what that sets a standard of, is that we can have somebody who makes a claim and the American people aren't allowed to know who it is, what their background is, but we have to go forward with removing them.
Andrew, thanks a lot for the call. John, that's, I think, related to that issue of the whistleblower and whether they should testify before the Senate or not, and we should know who they are.
Yep, okay. Well, you know, in criminal cases, some criminal cases start with an anonymous tip to the police or with information brought to law enforcement from a confidential informant. The tipster, the informant may or may not end up testifying. I understand the argument that the whistleblower, you know, in order to fully corroborate the whistleblower's statement, it would be best to have the whistleblower testify. The federal whistleblower statute doesn't necessarily want that to happen, in a sense. And just like in a criminal case, although impeachment is not a criminal case, it's really up to the prosecution, in this case the Democrats, to come up with enough evidence that's going to corroborate and support the whistleblower's initial tip. And it'll be up to the defense, in this case the Republicans, the Trump White House, to sort of throw out enough questions about the whistleblower's tip and the evidence brought by the prosecution.
Thanks for that call. Going out to Spencer with us in Waukesha. Spencer, hi.
Hello there.
What'd you want to bring up, Spencer?
This just seems like more of a waste of time and a smokescreen. The conclusion to this seems to be already decided, so we're just dinking around. This might have negative consequences on the election that's coming up because there's three standing senators that are running in the Democratic primary that are going to be negatively affected by this if it keeps dragging on and on. And I think the American public could give a crap about it. Like, maybe if we really wanted to clean the swamp, we should pursue the Epstein case to its full conclusion and prosecute everyone involved.
Spencer, thanks for the call. Spencer, seeing a waste of time, given that we know the likely conclusion, and just a waste of time and resources, I guess, in the impeachment. What do you think, John?
Well, that's hard to disagree with, because we can sort of predict pretty accurately how it's going to turn out. You know, Trump is going to be acquitted. I think what the caller points out as well is the political calculations that all involved in this are dealing with, that the three Democratic senators who are not on the campaign trail are going to be affected. The other senators who are up for re-election in their home states, they are going to be affected. The Trump campaign will be affected. The ultimate president, the Democratic nominee at some point will be affected by all of this. And you know, it's those political calculations that may be right and may be wrong. And I think the fact is, although we can sort of predict the outcome of the impeachment, it's sort of predicting the outcome of the political process and the 2020 election is going to be incredibly difficult.
Thanks for the call. Ken joins us next in Waukesha. Ken, hi.
Hey, how are you? I just had a brief comment and a brief question. The comment was to your previous caller who was very much concerned about who the whistleblower is and what their background is. And my comment is, I don't think it really matters because the Trump administration has essentially admitted to everything that the whistleblower claimed happened, but simply says that it's not a big deal. And then my other my question is, why can't we hear from Donald Trump himself under oath? I mean, we heard from Bill Clinton under oath, and I know that was, you know, in front of Ken Starr and not in front of the Senate, but I don't understand why we can't ask him what happened under oath.
Ken, thanks for that call. Let's tackle that second question, probably just in our last couple of minutes. John, we at no point has President Trump been under oath as related to the Ukraine issue, as far as I know, anyway.
No. And that's a really, really good point. With President Clinton, there was an independent counsel investigation, and he testified as part of that. And that sort of drew out the Monica Lewinsky allegations, which led to his subsequent testimony under oath. But his testimony under oath was to the independent counsel. It was not to Congress. And for Congress to demand that a sitting president testify under oath in a congressional investigation would raise a separation of powers issue that would be incredibly difficult to resolve and would ultimately probably bring in the U.S. Supreme Court. And so we have to remember, finally, that with the impeachment process, not only is it partisan, where you have one political party going after the other political party that controls the White House, but it is also a separation of powers issue, where Congress is engaged in a conflict with the executive branch. And it's in those separation of powers conflicts where ultimately you have to rely on the two branches to resolve it. And it is not going to help things if one branch demands that the other testify under certain conditions.
We'll keep on watching. John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right. Thank you for having me.
John Blakeman is a professor and chair of the Political Science Department at UW Stevens Point and co-author of The Supreme Court and the New Federalism, From the Rehnquist to the Roberts Court. We talked with him today about day two of the question phase in President Trump's impeachment trial in the Senate. Senators are expected to vote on whether or not to hear from witnesses tomorrow. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll get another update on the latest news in the impeachment trial and look at the impact it could have down the road. Plus, if you're trying to stick with an exercise program, music can make all the difference. Our guest helps us create a high motivation workout playlist, and you can join in and share some of your favorites. And it's this week's edition of Food Friday. The creator of Half-Baked Harvest joins the show for some pre-cooking. We'll get some great meals we can make in advance and then serve on a moment's notice. All that and look at some of the top news of the day coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.